Welcome to Going Deep, Sports in the 21st Century on Blue Ridge Public Radio. I'm Dr. Marcia Mount Shoup.
And I'm Coach John Shoup.
John's coached at the highest levels of the game of football for 26 years.
And Marcia is an author, theologian, and minister.
And we're glad you've joined us to go deep into some of the most pressing issues of our time.
On Going Deep, we go beyond the sound bites and highlight reels.
Hi, I'm Matt Bush, the news director for Blue Ridge Public Radio. I also help the Shoups produce Going Deep, and in this episode, we wrap up the eventful 2017-2018 college basketball season. This episode was originally broadcast as a Facebook Live discussion on the Blue Ridge Public Radio's Facebook page on Monday, March 26th. March may blow in like a lion and out like a lamb, or vice versa, but in between there's madness, and this year's version of March Madness has not disappointed. Had an historic upset, another Cinderella that's capturing the hearts of fans all over the country, and a classic contest between two of the sport's blue bloods that delayed a major news story nationally on Sunday. But scandal still hangs over the head of the sport, and after the nets are cut down in San Antonio and Columbus this weekend, we'll go back to headlines about investigations and punishments of schools, including some of the most prestigious basketball programs in the United States have been caught up in this particular scandal. So let's try to put some of that in perspective tonight with our hosts, John and Marcia. And we'll start with this. You guys did a show at the beginning of this college basketball season with Joe Nocera, a writer for the New York Times, about this scandal. And basically the crux of it was there was nothing really new about what was happening with this FBI investigation that allegedly showed big-time programs paying players to come to those universities. You were almost asking, what's the scandal? Is that correct? And tell us why you think that.
Well, there's a difference between what's the scandal and this has been going on for a long time. In my perspective, the whole thing is a scandal. This is March Madness is America's festival of exploitation. So the whole thing is a scandal. And so I think our point was that these shoe deals have been around for decades. And, the under the table part is the players profiting from that sum. Why shouldn't they? Universities have been profiting from those deals, and the people who opened the door and welcomed those deals with open arms were college presidents. So that's the scandal, if you ask me, not that the people who are actually, generating interest in the shoes and making this business run are making some money. That shouldn't be a scandal.
Well, every time that I have a conversation with Joe Nocera about college sports, we always tend to relate it to prohibition. And I think that's a really fair analogy, because what we're seeing now is this seedy underbelly of, son of a gun, players are getting paid. Well, players have always been getting paid. Players have always been getting improper benefits. We just happen to see it maybe a little bit more now in the public, but frankly, I've seen it up close for a spell. Just because there's rules in the 1920s that kept people that told people to not drink alcohol didn't mean that they didn't drink alcohol, make alcohol, distribute alcohol. Just because the NCAA has rules that say you're not allowed to pay players, players are paid. Players are paid in a lot of different ways. And, I had a friend of mine that coaches, football in the SEC, and he recently said to me, it's hard to do this job and be a good guy anymore. I'm not sure you could do this job and be an honest person. I think I ran into a little bit of that, too, whenever I was coaching last, that if you really want to compete, you got to make a decision, almost like in my history class tomorrow, we're going over Machiavelli. I was thinking about it today. Does the ends justify the needs? If you want to win a championship, Are you willing to do what you got to do to win a championship? And in Sean Miller's case, it was, perhaps I got to offer $100,000 to this guy under the table. Does the end justify the means? For me, I didn't feel like it did.
Well, and I mean, part of this is circular too, right? Because it all begs the question, why shouldn't the players be getting paid above the table? Why is there this, you know, kind of under the table way of doing it? Why can't we put it all on top of the table and talk about a different model of doing this thing that is generating billions of dollars?
So right before the tournament started, the news was broken of this FBI wiretap that supposedly caught Sean Miller, the head coach of the University of Arizona. John has a very nice anecdote he's going to share with us about Sean Miller later. But but that he was caught on tape offering $100,000 under the table to, you know, allegedly again, to DeAndre Ayton, who's a player who played for Arizona this year, is expected to be one of the top picks in this coming NBA draft. Has anything about that surprised or changed your thoughts on this particular scandal?
Not really. Perhaps the thing that has surprised me most about this is that Sean Miller and DeAndre, Sean coached in the tournament and DeAndre played in the tournament. The NCAA just let it go for the time being. Let's get through this tournament. When I coached at the University of North Carolina and coached football there in 2010, we had, I think, to open the season against LSU in the Chick-fil-A game, I want to say we had 13 or 14 mm-hmm. players that were suspended. Some of them had like an extra 12 minutes of tutoring from a tutor that no longer worked for the university. And the NCAA and the University of North Carolina deemed those improper benefits. Legitimately, there was a player, a Nashville player, Johnny White, had to write a check for like $7.50 to this tutor to be eligible to play. And they have Sean on tape offering $100,000 to someone. The FBI's involved. And what I'm surprised about, really, is that Sean coached and DeAndre played.
Are you really surprised? I mean, let's
well,
let's
I guess, I mean, what is that? Is yeah. this, I mean, you guys have been very
maybe the younger me would have been surprised.
But what is this a sign of? Is this a sign of change of NCAA punishments evolving, or them no. the North Carolina scandal that you know you guys saw up close? Obviously, was one that sent out a lot of ripple effects with all these other things. Is this beginning to see the changes, or what is it?
Go ahead.
I was just going to say the North Carolina scandal. What it showed was football ain't basketball.
Mm-hmm.
Basketball ain't football, and that basketball is the NCAA's cash cow. March Madness is the NCAA's cash cow. And so what they do to preserve that is they look the other way. It's the same reason North Carolina's football team was penalized for the scandal, and when things got more clear about where this came from and other players that were involved, all of a sudden the NCAA isn't really concerned about academic stuff anymore. So I do think it's just it's a metric that they've used time and time again.
Is it also partly because North Carolina basketball, Arizona basketball, those are two, you probably said, the top 10 or 15 programs in the country. Mm-hmm. No offense to the North Carolina football program, but that's right. not one Mm-mm. of the top 10 or 15 programs right. in the no. country. That's also something that's always been said about the NCAA. It doesn't really want to hammer its big-time programs. Does that play into this some too?
Those big programs have power, right?
Well, sure it does. I mean, when Cam Newton was a senior mm-hmm. at Auburn, I think he was suspended for all of half
minutes.
Of a Thursday practice, you know, and our players were suspended and banned for life. You know, if there's one thing that I think has changed is I do think North Carolina and basketball and maybe Auburn football kind of laid out a blueprint after what happened to the North Carolina football team in 2010, kind of laid out a blueprint of fight back. Frankly, the NCAA is impotent. I mean, if just fight back. And it's the university that punishes the players, that punishes the coach. And the NCAA is made up of all the universities. And so if those universities just fight back, there's really nothing Mark Emmert can do. He really, it's almost like the Wizard of Oz. It's almost like he's powerless to some degree.
Well, if people stop cooperating, I mean, it's...
Which is what Arizona did. Arizona right. said, we're standing behind our coach. Sean said, no, that's not how it happened. Arizona said, we're standing behind our coach. I mean, North Carolina football in 2010 said, we'll serve up our head coach as a piece of take him to stay away from basketball. And, you know, they basically told the NCAA to get lost, and they coached in the tournament and played in the tournament.
But to talk about March Madness is to talk about, I think, a bit of how it sort of has this allure on us. You just said it's the annual festival towards exploitation. A lot of people might find that quite harsh. But I know where you're going to go with this. But I think first to really to say, what about this particular event? What about March Madness really captures our imagination as fans?
I mean, the Loyola story. That's what it is. I mean, it's the fact that, you know, the underdog can come and, you know, nobody knows what's going to happen, last minute shots. I mean, it's exciting. It's intoxicating. I mean, it really is an amazing, you know, few weeks of just adrenaline rushes one after the other. And, you know, despair and delight and all the different things that come with it. And it's all packaged in this way that we can participate with the brackets and, you know, with these stories that we hear about different people. And it's just there's a sense in which it's a performance or a reenactment of all the things we love to think are true about sports. You know, we love to hear about people's hard work. I mean, so much of the rhetoric every year is around, why not us? You know, nobody expected us to be here, but we knew, we believed in ourselves. And that's a really powerful narrative. And we want to believe that it can work and that redemption happens.
But what about the exploitation that you find so critical of this? Obviously, billions of dollars are certainly wagered, but also is kind of spent in all these sorts of with you know, television contracts and all the things that come with it. So much money is spent during this month on college basketball. So the exploitation is?
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, just look at this, at the whole business model. Billions of dollars are generated with the help of apparel, TV, you know, all sorts of other kind of ancillary ways that money is made. And the people who are on the court generating this excitement, making those last-minute shots, giving us these stories that we love, aren't paid a dime. People push back and say, but they're getting an education. Well, many of them are not receiving a meaningful education because of the demands of this sport. The hours that they have to spend, the classes they can't take, especially with basketball players, the amount of time they're on the road and having games, and just this tournament. These guys aren't in class. They're not able to take exams or write papers. I mean, this is a really stressful run for them, and they're students. They're students in college, and just think about how their kind of reward for being a part of this is just, wasn't that fun? Wasn't that exciting? we think you're great. But there's no kind of investment in who they are and what they're doing for the university that goes past, you know, what have you done for us lately?
Yes. And the coaches, that the head coach specifically is often, you know, I mean, Mike Krzyzewski gets over $10 million a year. And when people talk about an education, there's a couple of things that I think people need to understand. I've been on the inside. Getting a degree from a university is not the same as getting an education from a university. Those are very different. If we look at the Power Five conferences, the Power Five conferences are the Atlantic Coast, the Southeastern Conference, the Big Ten, the Pac-10, and the Big 12. Those are the five main athletic conferences. Of their basketball teams, 60% of their men's basketball players are people of color. 66%. At those Power Five schools, those same schools, under 2% of the regular student body at those schools are people of color. And so 66% of the basketball team are 66, and these guys are the ones that are making money for every other sport at the school. They're supporting every other sport at the school, and I've been on the inside of it. And frankly, I was taken aback with it. Players do not get to choose what courses they want to take. You could go to Northwestern University and say, I want to study journalism. You're not going to study journalism unless your head coach in football or basketball says it's okay and it doesn't interfere mm-hmm. with the practice schedule. You're going to study what the head coach is mandated that you study. And so, yes, while North Carolina might have a wonderful business school and while Arizona might have a wonderful religion department, if you're a scholarship athlete in football or basketball, you're not in those. It's going to be tough. If you're the star player, if you're one of – you're not in those. And so – under 50% of those 66 students, under 50% ever get a degree from that university. And who knows what the percentage is of those that get a degree of something that is useful,
that's
is
meaningful for them,
is something that they intended to get a degree. It was something that really surprised me. We left the NFL after 12 years to go to college thinking this is going to be great. It's going to kind of be a both-and world. We're going to combine academics and athletics, and it's not like that. It's not like that.
So what is the reforms that – what are the reforms that are needed? Is it just paying players?
Well, that's an interesting question. And there's more and more careful research is going into like what would it really mean to pay players and where is the kind of public will to do that or to not do that. A recent study played out that 2 out of 3 people in America do not think that college athletes should be paid. Now that is when you break that down based on the respondents' race. White people, the majority of white people don't think players in revenue sports should be paid, but the majority of people of color do think they should be paid. So to me, part of the reform is a larger question about our country's ability to look at economic equity and race and how this is just another container for racialized disadvantage. One one of the interesting things to me is that students who attend the Power Five conferences are some of the most vehement resistors to the idea of paying players. But they love to watch. They love that this is part of their school, but they have been so invested in this model of, I don't even think it's amateurism necessarily for fans. I think it's the institution, my alma mater, the school that I love, and that would somehow change what this is about, that it's not about love of the school. Mm-hmm. I know one of the things that really made an impression on me when we were in the world of college football is how so many of the athletes don't have those warm feelings for their school. By the time they're gone, they don't feel that way about the school the same way other graduates do. And how so much is kind of built on the backs of this whole class of people that aren't really participating in the life of the college and the university the same way everybody else is. So I think part of the reform is unearthing some of those biases that we have. And then I think another one is to start to think about how can we answer the question of why the talents that show up on the basketball court and show up on the football field that we so highly value aren't valued on our college campuses the same way that somebody who's good at math is, or somebody who's good at drama or good at...
I've heard people say this. If you're in, you can sign with an agent in college for anything but sports if you're good at whatever you might, you might be good at.
And sports is a business in our country. So mm-hmm. why don't we professionalize that more? Why don't we create, conservatory models for athletes so that during the season they're not playing as much or they're not going to class as much. Or maybe they have internships to learn about coaching. We've done it with people who are good at the cello. Why can't we do it with this? It just seems like part of what we need to do is fully bring out into the conversation some of the questions about those kind of mental shortcuts that we make about why it's okay to treat this group of people this way and this group of people this way.
So let's look at something from the university angle when you're talking about potential reforms and all this. What do you tell a university? We'll take UMBC, the team, the school that first in the men's tournament to win as a 16 seed, did it this year. Mm-hmm. UMBC, which is the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, I'm sure most people in the country did not know that until this month.
The Terriers, right?
Retrievers.
Retrievers, I'm sorry. That's right.
That's a very different dog.
It's a very different dog. It's awesome. Chesapeake Bay Retrievers in particular. That's awesome. So think of all the free advertising that they've gotten, which we've kind of been able to show right here, and the fact that mm-hmm. we now know their nickname, and we know that UMBC stands for University of Maryland, Baltimore County, and we found out that before they won that game, their most famous team that they had on campus was their chess team. that's unbelievable free advertising for a university. Mm-hmm. So if you look for reform, how do you address that? That universities will see, hey, my school's basketball team does very well in March, that's just free advertising for an entire month.
Nobody's going to try to argue that it's not working for some people. It is. And, I mean, again, let's just get it out on the table. Is that the metric by which we make other decisions on college campuses? Is that the way we accredit schools? Or is that the way we rationalize other choices about how higher education works in our country? No. But it is for this. So it's sort of an interesting study in, I guess it's sort of Machiavellian, of like that these values are okay over here, mm-hmm. but they're not okay over here. Because, equity seems to be a value that we have in other parts of what it means to be a strong university. not just, hey, who gets the commercial advantage here? Who gets free advertising? And I don't think it's – I don't think we have to live in an either-or world about this, too. Who says that that has to go away just mm-hmm. because we cultivate a system in which there would be fairness around the economics of it?
There's something interesting about UMBC, and there's something interesting about some of these schools that you don't traditionally think of as the Power Five.
Mm-hmm. Hmm.
And – that is their course and schedule offerings and stuff like that, I think makes them a little bit unique. And schools like UMBC offer tons of night courses, tons of courses on the computer. You could take courses basically from anywhere in Baltimore County mm-hmm. while you're going to that school. Whereas some of the Power Five conferences, you have to be in a classroom. You have to be at this place. So they have some creativity in how they offer classes, which can help a player get a meaningful and useful degree because the courses I want to take might be offered at 8 o'clock at night. Mm-hmm. Well, you're probably not going to have practice at 8 o'clock at night. The window is 2 to mm-hmm. 6. Or I could take this class online, which isn't the case necessarily at a North Carolina or at a University of Virginia. So I think that's an important thing. But I think the big thing here, too, is where the NCAA does have some teeth is where they dictate rules of eligibility. Mm-hmm. And so they dictate that you have to have 9 hours of credit in this semester, 9 hours of credit in the next semester, and I want to say like 24 in a year before you're eligible for the next year. So that lends itself to schools like North Carolina, one, putting players in easy classes because if they don't get those 9 credits and they start the season eligible, but then basketball goes into the second semester as well, now all of a sudden they're not eligible. That's not good for the basketball program. So there's incentive to put players in easy courses, not just ones that coincide with the class or with the practice time.
And keep them eligible.
But to keep them eligible. And then there's a third incentive. I don't know if UMBC's coach has this, but at these Power Five schools, coaches make bonuses. I mean, thousands, tens of thousands of dollars bonuses. I've made bonuses for players achieving certain grade point averages. So that's the third thing. I, as a coach, have zero incentive mm-hmm. in having a player take a difficult class that challenges them and he gets a D in it because I get a few thousand dollars if my position group is the highest on the team, let alone the importance of a player remaining eligible, let alone the importance of a player being at practice, not skipping practice. So there's a lot of levels, and maybe UMBC has some advantages that the Power Five schools don't have, that those aren't issues.
We'll wrap it up with this, with fandom. You had Bob Orr in here. We will have some episodes with him coming up in the coming weeks. And he, retired Supreme Court, North Carolina Supreme Court Justice, mm-hmm. was a lawyer that's been fighting the NCAA, was also a lawyer that you met during your time at University of North Carolina, advocating for players' rights, said something along the lines of, I'm the problem. I gave up my season tickets. I don't do this anymore. But if someone comes to you and says, hey, you want to go to the game? I always say, sure.
Mm-hmm.
How do you fight that?
I don't know if you do. I really don't. I mean, I feel like you don't fight it. You appeal to that passion and say, this is something that you love. So hold something that you love to a high standard. It's not a sustainable system the way it is. And the people like Bob who know about the underside of it, just like us, it does take some of the joy out of it. It does take something away from, I mean, I haven't filled out a bracket in a few years. I mean, I'll watch something. I'll watch if Kentucky's playing or something. But,
right. I think everybody has that. I didn't watch a whole lot of basketball this year. But right. I don't know. I won't tell you how much that had to do with Pitt going winless. But there was a correlation.
But I do think it, instead of trying to fight what people love, use that to create change. That can help us love it with an open heart and a free conscience. I mean,
I've got feelings like you. I grew up outside Pittsburgh, and I've got feelings invested in Pitt basketball. I mean, I remember Jerome Lane and Charles Smith, and I root for that program. But it's hard for me to do it, to root for college sports right now when I know how unfair it is. I would love to just start it fair, make it fair for everybody, and go from there. And I would enjoy college sports so much more. But I got to tell you, it is hard for me to watch knowing that when a team loses, I know players. I know scholarship athletes that have come to me and said, "Coach, I'm hungry. It's spring break. I haven't eaten in 3 days. Coach, I'm cold. I need a coat. Coach, how can I get home? I don't have any money to get home." I know those players. Marcia knows those players. They ain't going to the president of the university, and they're not going to Mark Emmert. They're coming to me. And it does. It makes it hard for me to watch the games because I think of those stories. I just want to start it fair because there's enough money to go around. Anybody that says there isn't is lying. There's enough money to go around. I just want to start it fair, and I think I'd fall in love with college sports again.
So you mentioned the Pitt teams of the 80s with Jerome Lane and Charles Smith. Their point guard was Sean Miller.
Yes, he was.
So why don't you share with us your Sean Miller story?
Well, Sean Miller, let's see. Sean Miller and I are were the same grade. He went to Blackhawk High School, and in Major Harris went to Brashear there in town as well. But Sean Miller and I think one night combined for 47 points. I think Sean had 45.
So you just held him to 45 on defense that night.
Yeah. He was a great player.
Were you guarding him?
Yeah. I mean, he was a great player.
Before we go, I must also ask you about Sister Jean.
Oh, yes.
The team chaplain, the 98-year-old nun for Loyola of Chicago, which has made the Final Four, and that's sort of everyone's Cinderella sweetheart this year. As Reverend Mountshoup, what would you say about Sister Jean? And what about her sort of getting into the headlines as this team has done well? What do you just think of that?
Oh, I think a lot of stuff about that. We probably don't have time for my total thoughts. But I think several things. One is, she's adorable. She's lovable. She's, I can see why she's caught on. Who doesn't love a 98-year-old nun that knows every nook and cranny of her basketball team? And it sounds like she has endless supplies of energy, and she's beloved. So that what's not to love there? I do think it's interesting how people, there always are these kind of little pop-up commodities that come out in the March Madness madness. And this year, it's a 98-year-old nun, and sort of what's getting commodified is religion and faith and prayer and even Lent, she's like, I gave up losing for Lent, And I think it's so, as a person of faith who is walking with a faith community during Lent, where we talk about that our faith does really kind of put us on the losing end of things a lot of the time. That it's not about winning in the world's terms. And I just think it's interesting how faith has kind of been commodified in this kind of contorted way because of this adorable person that's quick with the tongue and can make quips like that. I also think it's interesting to see what a different dynamic someone like her has in a Catholic university. And Villanova is the same way. I've been there to be on a panel and was very impressed with how different it is to have a chaplain's office and people who are steeped in a faith tradition that is kind of a shared culture there, how much deeper they can go around the character building of sports, the spiritual, you know, challenges of sports. And I think it's neat to see a place that kind of has more of a culture of support and theological reflection. You do not see that in universities that have chaplains that don't share the faith of that culture or haven't been trained in any way to speak the language of faith with a broad range of people. So I think that part is cool, but the fact that there's a bobblehead ever is a little it's a little disturbing, but we'll go with it.
You've been listening to Going Deep, Sports in the 21st Century, from the studios of Blue Ridge Public Radio, NPR for Western North Carolina. Tell us what you think of the show by emailing us at goingdeep@bpr.org. Make sure to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter as well, @ShoopsGoingDeep.